It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest news from Congress, from the controversial release of an American POW in Afghanistan to Senate candidate Joni Ernst, who's trying to make history as Iowa's first woman in Congress.
First, if you've been outside recently, chances are you were hit with an unpleasant realization. Mosquitoes are back, and this time they've returned in greater numbers than before.
Seems too early in the season to be dealing with our unofficial state bird, too early to me anyway. So why are we seeing, or so it seems, so many mosquitoes?
To explain what's behind the mosquito outbreak and what to expect in the coming months, we've got PJ Leash with us here in the studio. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, pleasure to be here.
Well, it seems like it's bad to me, but just how bad have the mosquitoes been so far this year?
Well, it really depends on where you are in the state. And certainly I was up in the northern half of the state Memorial Day weekend, and it seemed like it got to be Sunday afternoon and someone turned a switch on. All the mosquitoes seemed to have come out at once. So I've gotten several calls the past few days and last week about the northern part of the state, and it certainly sounds like they're having mosquitoes out in force.
Now, the hope this winter was that it's so cold, all the mosquito eggs will be frozen, the mosquitoes will die, and we'll have no mosquitoes. It seems like the opposite happened. What happened? What weather conditions created this outbreak?
Well, we certainly did have an unusual winter. It was brutally cold, and a lot of people either thought or maybe hoped that insects like mosquitoes would have really been hit hard by the winter. Now, it depends on the mosquito species, but a lot of mosquitoes can actually spend the winter as eggs that are laid along bodies of water or in depressions out in the woods. And so those eggs would have been covered by snow. And in the state, we had pretty solid snow cover from parts of December into even parts of early May, depending on where you're located. And that solid snow cover really served as a good insulator. And so those eggs were protected. They didn't experience the same minus 20 degree temperatures that we did. Hmm. And so they were relatively warm under that snow, so to speak.
Well, mosquitoes, I'm sure, are food for lots of things, but we're the food for mosquitoes, so it's hard to be positive about that. But now it's spring, and we've got different weather conditions. It seemed like a slow spring, but then all of a sudden, boom, it's warm. I don't know. What happened this spring that contributed?
It was an interesting spring, and I joke that we almost skipped spring entirely and went right to summer because in parts of the state we had snow cover and ice cover on lakes very late. And then within the same month, actually within the span of about 3 weeks, we went from that snow cover to 80-degree temperatures. And I think with the mosquitoes, insects in general are cold-blooded, and so whenever it gets warmer, their metabolism and physiology ramps up and they develop more quickly. And so I think that late snow break with a lot of snow melt and water, we've gotten a lot of rain lately, combined with warm temps, just caused a lot of mosquitoes to kind of come out all at once, and so it seems like this massive swarm just popped out of nowhere.
So you mentioned the northern part of the state being particularly bad. Is that where it's the worst, or is it going to be something that we're going to see in full force in all of Wisconsin?
Well, I'm curious to see myself, and in the Insect Diagnostic Lab, I do get calls in describing mosquito pressures from around the state. For the northern part of the state, it's really not uncommon to have these large mosquito populations. That just seems to be the norm. Now, the southern part of the state, I'm curious to see what we're going to get because we certainly have been getting a lot of rain lately. And at this point, it could indicate that we'll have strong mosquito numbers, but it's a little early to tell.
So there's hope, is what you're saying.
There is hope.
Of course, the rain is good, too.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting case. Certain mosquitoes breed in more permanent bodies of water. And so if we have water sitting around, the mosquitoes start to develop. If we get a large rainfall, an inch or two, in certain cases that can actually flush the mosquitoes out of where they're developing and they end up dying.
Is there an optimum number of mosquitoes, or is this a peak mosquito year?
That's definitely a good question. I mean, most people would say they'd be happy with no mosquitoes at all. From what I've been seeing so far, mosquitoes out in force, northern half of the state, but as I mentioned, it's really early to tell at this point what we're going to be seeing for the rest of the state this season.
But as a part of the ecosystem, we want some mosquitoes, right? Or things start breaking down.
Well, yes, mosquitoes can serve as food source for aquatic organisms, frogs, small fish, that sort of thing. So they do play an overall role in the ecosystem out there.
Now, in terms of, you know, the kind of mosquitoes, I always just assumed there's a mosquito. Is that true? Is there just a type of mosquito that's bothering everyone from the south to the north, or are there all different varieties?
There are all different types of mosquitoes in the state, and we actually have just over 50 different species of mosquito. They all have slightly different habits in terms of where they live, how they spend the winter, that sort of thing. What we're probably seeing in the northern half of the state at the moment are what we call some of our nuisance mosquitoes or floodwater mosquitoes. These are mosquitoes that rely on meltwater from snow or from flooding situations to develop, and they can be different from some of our mosquitoes that transmit diseases.
Now, one concern, of course, is the West Nile virus, which has shown up for the past several years, been around for a while. Do we need to be concerned about that, especially this year?
Well, it's a little early to tell, and I have been checking some records. We do have two confirmed cases of birds positive for West Nile so far in the state, but it depends on what mosquitoes we're going to see. The mosquito that we most associate with West Nile, called Culex pipiens, tends to breed or develop in more permanent bodies of water, so shallow ponds or even containers. So if you had, say, an empty bucket in your yard that filled up with water, that's where that particular mosquito likes to breed. Now, those mosquitoes like to stay in that water for quite a while. And so if I mentioned earlier, if we get a lot of rainfall, it could even flush them out of the system. But when we get the large amount of rain, it's more of the floodwater mosquitoes, some of our more what we call nuisance mosquitoes that aren't associated with diseases like West Nile.
So obviously, if you're looking to avoid the threat of West Nile, you want to not be bitten by mosquitoes. To that end, what can we do? Is it just dousing yourself with bug repellent?
Well, insect repellent definitely is an important aspect of that to prevent mosquito bites. A couple other things you can do. If you can avoid being out in the evening or early at dawn, those are the periods when mosquitoes are most active. And so if you don't need to be out at that time of day, that's a good way to avoid mosquitoes altogether. If you are going to be out in the evening or early dawn hours, having on long sleeves, long pants, that'll help prevent mosquito bites as well.
Do you know anything about some of the new mosquito technology? I've seen things that you can wear on your wrist and they supposedly emit a blast of something that frightens the mosquitoes or repels the mosquitoes. Do things like that work? What works?
Well, when it comes down to what works, it seems like the mosquito repellent. They've been around a long time. They definitely work. There's all kinds of unusual devices out there. There are some sonic devices that produce sounds. Supposedly they mimic the sound of dragonflies or other predators, but we just haven't seen research data suggesting that they work and provide relief for mosquitoes. There are, I've heard of a few cases of wristbands that may have a DEET or some other repellent in them, so they may provide some relief. But when it comes down to it, treating either your skin or clothing with an insect repellent seems to be the main way to protect yourself.
Is that what you do when you're out in the field and you really don't want to get bitten?
That is what I do, yes.
All right, that's what the pros do. And what about a face net? Do you ever go that far? I mean, this is a bad year, at least up north.
Well, if you were a diehard fisherman and you wanted to be out, or just diehard outdoors person, you wanted to be out in the woods and the mosquitoes or black flies are bad, you know, a face net can keep them at bay.
All right. Well, PJ, thank you so much. And we'll be on the lookout and see what happens with these mosquitoes we're seeing.
Thank you.
Talking to PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab.
It's time for our weekly update on Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Last night, we saw primary results from Mississippi and Iowa.
Mississippi will go into a runoff election after a campaign with some significant drama, and Joni Ernst is hoping to make history in Iowa after taking the GOP Senate nomination. Iowa has never sent a woman to Congress.
And two controversies continue in Congress with the release of a prisoner of war, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, and legislation aimed at addressing the VA scandal now facing the Senate. Paul Singer joins us each week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing good. How about you?
So far, so good.
Well, this release, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the White House exchanged five Taliban leaders, evidently detained at Guantanamo, for his release. Congress, many members of Congress, not happy about this. Would Congress usually play a role in this kind of deal?
Well, Congress is supposed to be briefed. They're not. I think part of the issue here is that Congress feels that they were kept in the dark. It's not necessarily that they would play a part in a deal like this, as it is that the administration is supposed to tell them that they're about to do it. In this case, it came as a surprise to everybody. And Democrats and Republicans both on Capitol Hill are saying, you know, we got no warning of this at all. It was a done deal before anybody told us. And in fact, even as we speak, a bunch of White House officials are heading up to Capitol Hill now to brief senators now on what we know about Bergdahl. There has been some question about exactly why he was captured in the first place. He was the only prisoner that we had in Afghanistan. And there is some suggestion that he essentially walked off his duty and was captured because he had more or less quit. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great deal of concern about both the nature of how he came to be captured and the nature of how this prisoner swap took place, particularly in the fact that Americans have generally maintained that we do not negotiate with terrorists and we don't engage in prisoner swaps.
So how much of the anger from Congress has been kind of this breach of protocol, not informing Congress in advance, and how much of this has been criticism of the deal itself, the exchange itself?
You know, I think it starts with the concern, as always with Congress, it starts with the concern over their priorities, sorry, their prerogatives. Mm-hmm. And their jurisdiction. They get mad when they don't get a proper protocol and they don't get briefed. Then you get the political element here of the question of, did we trade too much? Are we allowing these five Taliban guys to go back in the field and you know, re-engage the battle against Americans or against Afghans in the field? That becomes and that's a legitimate debate. But then, of course, you have your political season going on here, so they want to blame Obama for handling it wrong or being having the wrong position on terrorism. It's hard sometimes to separate the legitimate concern about was this an appropriate transaction from the political opportunity to make a point to blame Obama for something bad.
Whether it's for those policy reasons or for political reasons, are we going to see panels, say, in the House run by Republicans looking into this deal?
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll definitely see a plenty of opportunity for oversight. I would be, you know, the House is not going to create another special committee like they have on Benghazi, but they will definitely be having the House and even, I think, from the Senate, going to be having oversight hearings to look into how this trade went down. There's still some question about exactly was the country of Qatar serving simply as our – did they come to us first, or were they serving as our missionaries here on this exchange? You know, I think people are very concerned that Americans did not reach out to the Taliban and say, well, let's make a deal.
And I know we can't read the administration's mind here. They've presented this as an oversight. Is it likely that it was an oversight that they didn't reach out to Congress first, or was this one of those act first, apologize later, you know, don't ask for permission first in a way situations?
Yeah, I honestly don't know, Rob. I mean, it would not surprise me, given the political season that we're in, if the administration thought that it may not be to their advantage to talk to Congress first. On the other hand, I also think that they clearly underestimated the reaction. They were expecting a lot of praise for rescuing an American soldier. I think they underestimated, first of all, how much Congress would be concerned about the terms of this bargain, and then second of all, I think they really underestimated the concern about Bergdahl's background and whether he was really, you know, an upstanding member of the military. Now, I will tell you that USA Today had an editorial today, and I don't really usually read our editorials at all, by you know, for reasons of principle. I don't want to know what we think, but I will say that we had an interesting editorial today about this whole question of, you know, does Bergdahl's action matter? I mean, don't we have a commitment to our soldiers that we rescue them no matter what their sort of, you know, moral failings may have been? It's an interesting debate for us to have.
We'll keep watching that story. Another thing that came out this week that Congress has an interest in, new EPA regulations with the goal of cutting carbon emissions from power plants, mainly going to affect coal power plants by the year 2030. First, this is coming from the administration. Does Congress have a say in these regulations?
Well, you know, Congress has a say in these regulations because, to some degree, these are authorized by the Clean Air Act. I mean, there's been this long debate. Congress passed a law saying that EPA can regulate pollutants. And EPA said, well, then carbon should be a pollutant. And ultimately, they won in court. I mean, they're allowed to do this, right? So let's back up. First, the Congress actually has had a role in this thing. They created the law that EPA is using to regulate this, first thing. Second thing, these regulations are not final. They're going to spend a lot of time taking comment and receiving feedback and redesigning the rules as they do in any rulemaking process. So Congress can be involved in that process as well. And third, Congress still does have a trigger mechanism. They don't use it very often, that they're allowed to basically veto rules that the agencies pass. That's going to be down the road a piece. We'll see where we are in a couple of years when these rules are going to be final. You're not going to see a whole lot of activity, actual regulatory activity out of this process for quite a while. And sure, Congress is going to have hearings, and they're going to say these are dumb rules, these are bad rules, they're bad for whatever. And then other people will say, no, this is good, this is important, it's going to drive a lot of innovation. I'll tell you, I covered the Clean Air Act 15 years ago, and it was supposed to bankrupt America, if you believed the detractors, and it hasn't. So who knows? Maybe over time we'll discover that these rules are not going to be quite as burdensome as they're currently made out to be.
Well, let's look at the political fallout. Say you had a hypothetical Senate race that looked like it might be a close one in a coal-producing state like Kentucky. How's that going to affect that?
Well, I mean, I believe, and forgive me because it's been a long night, but I believe Allison Lundgren Grimes, the Democrat running in Kentucky, has already put out an ad today saying basically, send me to Congress so I can tell President Obama that his EPA regulations are stupid. This is the Democrat. Yeah? Mm. So there are a bunch of Democrats running away from these rules.
Well, hey, speaking of races for the Senate, a couple primaries yesterday, Mississippi and Iowa. Interesting Republican primary there in Mississippi. What happened there?
A six-term senator, the establishment senator Cochran from Mississippi, did not win his primary. Now, he didn't lose it either. Mm-hmm. He is stuck in a runoff against a Tea Party challenger named Chris McDaniel. This was a real bloody battle. They had at one point somebody who had supported McDaniel at some point went into the nursing home to take pictures of Cochran's bedridden wife. I mean, it got really ugly. Now the concern is it's three more weeks for this runoff of these two candidates slugging it out. The Republicans are concerned this is not going to be good for them at all. The Democrats nominated a guy, Travis Childers. He seems like a perfectly, non-controversial candidate amongst the Democrats, and he can just sit here and wait for this battle to play out for 3 weeks. That's going to be an advantage for the Democrats. Oh, now, whether they can ultimately win a statewide race in Mississippi seems, a bit of a stretch, but it's not good for the Republicans.
And Democrats are hoping that the Tea Party-affiliated challenger beats the long-term senator. They think they might have a better chance in that race.
Yeah. Yeah, and McDaniel, at one point, he was doing a lot of radio back in the day, talk radio, where he said a lot of fairly remarkable things and incendiary things. So there'd be plenty of fodder for a general election campaign.
And I think it was a five-way Republican primary for the Senate race in Iowa. What do we know about the winner there?
The winner is most famous for a television ad called Squeal, where she pointed out that she grew up on a farm castrating hogs, so she knows how to go to Washington and cut the pork. She was able to unite the Tea Party and Sarah Palin behind her, as well as some of the establishment Republican groups like the Chamber of Commerce, and she just wiped up the floor with her opponents, and she is now in pretty good position to run against Congressman Bruce Braley, the Democrat. They're running to replace Tom Harkin, one of the liberal lions of the Senate, who has decided to retire. And the Democrats are really in danger of losing a seat here if Jody Ernst can carry this one off.
And as we wrap it up, she'd be the first woman in Congress from Iowa?
Yeah. Go figure. I was never elected a woman to Congress. So odd little factoid of history, but yep, she'd be it.
Another race for us to watch between now and November. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He's politics editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to share the latest from the Capitol. Earlier this year, the preview of an article authored by two political scientists went viral. It suggested that the United States, known as the oldest democracy in the world, might not really represent the interests of its people all that well.
Their study concluded that not only do wealthy Americans move the levers of the financial world, but they also control the terms of public debate and ultimately national policy.
As campaigns for fall elections heat up and Americans wonder whether their votes matter, we've asked one of the authors of that piece to join us. Martin Gillens is a professor of politics at Princeton University. His forthcoming article in Perspectives on Politics is called Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. His co-author is Benjamin Page. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's look at kind of the current model of how representative government works in the United States. Not a pure democracy as that's defined, but the idea seems to be generally everybody's interests get represented by a group and it all comes to the table and something comes out of that that more or less represents us all. Is that kind of the base assumption of our civics classes, of our political science?
I think you have nailed it, and I also think that that's what most political science over the last few decades has purported to show.
Now, you tried to put that to the test, and you looked at a lot of public policy and things that were passed. How did you try to assess who really had a seat at the table when it came to passing laws and policies?
Well, we collected data on as many proposed changes to federal government policy as we could find over a period of about 25 years. And we had surveys that asked citizens at all income levels whether they favored or opposed each of these changes. And these changes could be anything that the federal government might plausibly do, social policies, economic policies, raising the minimum wage to, say, $6.25 an hour, sending troops to Bosnia, specific restrictions on abortion, whatever it was. Almost 2,000 examples of these kinds of possible policy changes. And for each of them, we had information on what ordinary citizens, that is, people at the middle of the income distribution, what we call economic elites, that is, affluent Americans, what they wanted, and codes for interest groups, how a set of the most powerful interest groups in Washington fell on each of these about 1,800 or so policy issues. And by statistically analyzing the relationship between what each of these sets of actors wanted, what average citizens wanted, what economic elites wanted, and what interest groups wanted, and comparing that to what the government did, we were able to assess where the power lies and how much influence each of those actors have.
And that leads to the next obvious question. Who had the weight? Whose interests were met by the laws and federal government changes that you looked at?
Well, nobody could dictate outcomes, but it was clear that interest groups and economic elites had considerable influence. The extent to which they favored or opposed some proposed policy change was strongly related to the likelihood of that change being adopted, but ordinary citizens had virtually no influence at all.
Now, some people have taken the preview of your paper and run with it and said, the United States, this paper proves the United States is an oligarchy. You don't use that word except referring to somebody else's work. Is that a fair takeaway from the research that you did, that we're an oligarchy, the power is concentrated in the hands of a few elites?
Well, of course, it depends on what you mean by oligarchy. But the reason we don't use that word is that it kind of conjures up an image of a small number of, you know, plutocrats, a small number of extraordinarily wealthy individuals who are pulling the strings to the exclusion of everybody else. And we don't really think that's what's going on. We think there's thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who have money and the willingness to use that money to try to influence policy. And I think it's also important to point out that there's not a line above which people have influence and below which people don't. It's more that of those people who are interested in shaping government action, the more money you have, the more influence you have.
And now there's been a debate spinning off from this about whether this is evidence of a flaw in the way our government works or whether it's working as designed by the founders who, in part, wanted to protect private property. Some of the initial framework of this country maybe intentionally gave more weight to elites. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I mean, that's certainly true. And I guess whether you see this as a, sort of a feature or a bug depends on what kind of a government you want. But you're quite right. I mean, you know, the founders thought only white male property owners were fit to participate in the political process. But, you know, over the centuries, we've expanded, certainly we've expanded the right to vote. We've expanded formal political equality. And we've adopted, I think, a strong sort of norm, a strong belief that in a democracy, in America, that average citizens should, if not have equal influence necessarily to those with more resources, at least have an important say over what their government does. And our work suggests that that's simply not the case.
I'm imagining, I'm pretty sure there are people out there listening and saying, well, yeah, I've been saying this all along, that wealthy people have too much power, too much influence, and that's bad. Why is it important to go out and try to put numbers to it and try to measure relative influence?
Well, one reason is that while there are people who've believed that, and there are political scientists who've believed that, there's also been a fair bit of research over a period of decades that seems to run contrary to that, that seems to show that ordinary citizens do have substantial influence. So one reason why I think this work is important is to really counter that notion, to show that, in fact, that's an illusion, and that if you look at the data properly, you don't see that kind of influence. And another reason is that, you know, there's lots of things that people believe, and social scientists go out and confirm them. And the typical response is, yeah, okay, great, we already knew that. You didn't need a big study. On the other hand, there's things people believe, and social scientists go out, and it turns out they're not the case. So it is important to confirm with actual hard evidence things that we may have anecdotal evidence for, but which nevertheless there's sort of room for debate.
Moving past the starting point of measuring the influence, do you have a notion of what mechanism at play here? Is it, hey, these are the people who make campaign donations, or these are people who move in the same social circles as elected representatives, or why do the wealthy people have more influence?
There's probably a role for a number of factors, including the sort of social circles that our decision makers move in, the fact that members of Congress and other political decision makers are themselves typically from very affluent backgrounds. You know, the Senate's often called the Millionaires Club. Those things may play a role, but I do think that money in politics, that donations to candidates, to political parties, to advocacy organizations, and of course the lobbying of business and industries, is the key factor. And even politicians who would prefer different sorts of policies have to rely on affluent donors in order to get into office in the first place and to stay in office.
It might be, again, a gut reaction for people to say, okay, a segment of the population is more influenced than the rest of it. The wealthy people do. This is a bad thing. Let's maybe step beyond the common sense. Is this bad? Is this unhealthy for the future of representative government in America?
Well, I think it's certainly unhealthy for the economic and social conditions of the middle class. Right, so we've seen over the last few decades how the middle class in this country has been hollowed out, how we've cut back on investing in ordinary Americans through cutbacks in, say, public support for education, K through 12, higher education, and so on. We've seen a variety of economic forces have pushed more and more of the rewards of our economy into the hands of fewer and fewer people. And while some of those forces are global, other countries have responded by adopting policies that help to ameliorate the growth of economic inequality, whereas in the United States over the last few decades, we've seen policies move in the other direction to further advantage those who have the most. So the consequences of government policy and who shapes it are enormous for the lives of ordinary Americans.
You know, no matter how wealthy you are, you still generally only get to vote once in an election. Wouldn't the counterbalancing force to this influence be Election Day, when there are more non-wealthy people casting ballots than wealthy people? Wouldn't that balance that influence out?
That's absolutely critical, and it does play some role. And there is some evidence in my work that during periods leading up to elections, especially presidential elections, that policies do tend to mirror somewhat more closely the preferences of a broader range of the public. Nevertheless, the candidates that we have to choose from when we go to the polls, at least candidates for federal office, for the president, for the Senate, for the House of Representatives, those candidates are all on the ballot because they have the support, either because they had a lot of money themselves or because they have the support of people with money. So to be a viable candidate to begin with, you have to be vetted, in a sense, by the economic elites of this country.
So by the time it comes to Election Day, the field has already been narrowed and the interests represented have been narrowed.
Yeah, no, that's true. Now, that's not to say that all candidates are equally reflective of the same policies or equally inclined to vote in Congress in ways that benefit particular groups. There certainly is a range. Traditionally, the Democratic Party has been a more consistent advocate for the needs of the middle class and the less well-off Americans, at least on some dimensions. But both parties are dependent on their affluent donors. And, you know, we've seen both parties adopt the same kinds of policies with regard to, say, the banking industry, right, in the wake of the Great Recession in 2008. We've seen, both parties have failed to rescind the tax advantages that go to hedge fund managers and so on. So you can't escape it. It's built into the system. Politicians depend on the wealthy.
We're talking to political scientist Martin Gillens. He's co-author of the article, Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. His article challenges the idea that the United States representative government represents most of the people of the United States.
And we want to know what you think. Some people have used a study to say that we live in an oligarchy. And do you think that we do? Do you think the government places the interests of the wealthiest citizens above everyone else's, and why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We're back with Martin Gillens, a politics professor at Princeton, and author of the forthcoming article, Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. His article went viral when it was previewed earlier this year, and it challenges the idea that the United States is a majoritarian democracy.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think the interests of wealthy people are overrepresented in decisions that the government, especially the federal government, make? Is there something that you would like to see change to change the landscape? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Martin, let's start with that last point, assuming that this is a thing that's bad for American politics, for a representative government. What are things that might be done to level the playing field to give average citizens more voice, more sway in federal government decision making?
I'd say the two most important things are to make elections more competitive, and that's not an easy thing to do, but things like nonpartisan districting have been shown to help, and clean election laws, public financing of elections can also contribute to greater competition. And the reason that that's helpful is that the work shows that when the parties are when government is divided, when control is uncertain, that policies tend to reflect the preferences of the public more so than when one party has strong control of government. So there is a role for political competition in disciplining the parties and sort of forcing them, because of the greater need for votes in close elections and when government is divided or closely held, And they respond to that by pursuing policies that are at least somewhat more popular with ordinary citizens. The second thing is clearly campaign finance reform and reducing the role of affluent donors in supporting the political system and thereby shaping the behavior of our representatives.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Gary on the line in South Milwaukee. Gary, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Gary?
Well, the question before the break was the politicians handle, help the poor, middle class, or the rich. I guess my question would be the amount of money that's being allowed in the campaigns for various elections, states, federal, local, wouldn't that kind of answer the question right there that these politicians, they're usually going, follow the money is what I was going to say. I think that's the main answer right there.
Gary, thanks for the call. And that's a point you were touching on just there, Martin. Follow the money. The people who have more money to throw into politics get more political attention.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So while it's true that politicians need votes, in order to get votes, they need money. And to some degree, there's at least we would hope a balancing act there that the preferences of voters constrain their representatives, but they aren't constraining them very much. And the role of money has apparently gotten larger. Certainly campaigns have gotten much more expensive over time. And with Supreme Court decisions that have been chipping away at campaign finance regulations, the situation is only getting worse.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Jim with us in Lincoln County. Hi there, Jim.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I think the one solution to all of this is that people need to vote. People don't vote. And the solution to that is to require people to be accounted for at the poll. That would handle our census issue, and it would get people to the polls.
Jim, thanks for the call. Mandatory voting, people bring up this idea on and off over the years in American politics. It is the law in some other countries, I know. Is that something that might, if they knew everybody was going to vote, politicians might pay more attention to everybody, Martin?
Well, I suppose in that regard it wouldn't hurt, but I'm not very optimistic. The voting rates for average citizens, that is people in the middle of the income distribution, and the voting rates for the affluent are not all that different. It's true that poor people vote at a discernibly lower level, and yet even middle-class Americans, we find, have very little influence. So I don't think it's primarily a lack of turnout, although, again, the more people that vote and the more attention they're paying to the policies of the people they're voting for, the better.
You know, one of the ideas, I think, in the current working model of most political science is that, no, maybe this one person doesn't make a difference, but they join a group. They're part of a union or the NRA or an environmental group or something like that. And their interests, because of the strength and the numbers of that organization they join, their interests do make a difference. That your research shows otherwise?
Well, I think that in theory that's great, and I do think that those kinds of organizations can be extremely helpful. Part of the problem, of course, is that those organizations, especially unions in this country, have been in decline. So one of the reasons why other countries' policies may be more consistent with what their citizens prefer is that they have those kinds of organizations, those kinds of sort of institutional mechanisms that can give voice to ordinary citizens. Things like labor parties and strong unions, which we've either never had in this country or which have been in decline for the last 50 years.
Back to our callers now with Steve joining us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, thank you. His note that the other countries have labor unions, which are labor parties, which are more effective, leads into my question. As Australia, I think, has voting is required. I don't know how they enforce that, but as voting is required, do we have notices of any other industrial democracies that have solved these same problems with greater efficacy so that we can learn from them rather than trying to reinvent the wheel here?
Steve, thanks for the call, Martin. Lessons from other countries that seem to represent more people better.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a very hard one to answer because there's so many things that differ across countries. It's hard to identify the role of any particular one. But it's certainly the case that in many European democracies, and perhaps Australia, I don't really know much about Australia, but in many democracies, their role of money in elections is, of course, much more tightly regulated. Political parties are funded by the public treasury,
and there's restrictions on the kinds of advertising and the length of campaign periods and so on. A whole variety of regulations that we lack. And while it's hard to say that that is the reason, it may contribute to a set of policies that are more beneficial and more popular among average citizens than what we see in the United States.
Thanks, Steve. We'll go to John now on the line with us in West Bend. John, hi.
Hello. My question, I have really two. One is, would term limits have an effect on this, according to your guest? And secondly, what if we put a tax on all political contributions?
John, thanks. Not much time left. Martin, first, term limits.
From what I know, I'm not an expert on this, but from what I know, term limits have turned out to be a pretty bad idea. What it has done is to reduce the amount of knowledge and expertise among office holders and shift power toward lobbyists and others who don't have term limits and who are pursuing their interests consistently year in and year out. In terms of how we treat campaign donations tax-wise, I think what we need to do is to encourage and subsidize, basically, campaign contributions among the less well-off. That in the current Supreme Court environment, restricting contributions from people who want to make them is very difficult, but finding ways to enhance the ability of ordinary citizens to have their voices heard by contributing to campaigns and parties can be very helpful. And there's examples of that in the states, in New York City, and in other places where there's things like matching contributions for small donors. So that would be the direction that I would think would be the most promising in terms of how we treat campaign donations.
And Martin, just briefly, usually when you submit an article to a political science journal, you don't get mass media attention. Were you surprised by the big reaction you got to this paper?
I was surprised and very gratified to know that not only is this a issue that's of such great concern, but that there's a role for academics who often spend their time speaking only to other academics, but that people like myself can contribute to a broader conversation I think is really important and, like I say, very gratifying.
Martin, thanks for having the conversation with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Martin Gillens. He's politics professor at Princeton University, author of an article not even published yet, Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens.